And welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous guest who's returning for a second time for some strange reason. I guess we'll find out why. We have Ross Monroe here, his film Booster McGee. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So how have you been?
Oh, good. Just, here in Vancouver and just working on more film stuff. And everything's going pretty good out here. And thanks for asking. It's raining, of course, in Vancouver, as usual.
It's always raining in Vancouver. I'm convinced it never stops.
Yeah.
My first question was straight off the gate. You have 16 years between your two films?
I did Brewster McGee was my first feature, and then pretty well around 16 years. Like, believe it or not, I spent so much time working on Brewster, and then I must have spent a good 3, 4, 5 years, promoting it, and then I came out with the special edition DVD, and I wanted to spend a couple years promoting that, and then started working on new scripts, and by the time we started, my wife, Marie, who's my producer, by the time we actually started going to production, like, I was shocked to see that all those years had gone by. It was amazing.
So, did you think it was going to take you 16 years to write your second feature?
Absolutely not. I was always behind the scenes writing a lot of scripts, and I just ended up, Legacy of Whining was the next feature script I did, but I probably wrote about 6 feature scripts like in between. So it never really felt like I wasn't involved with film because I just kept working on scripts, and I was convinced I was just going to, work on one of them. But I tried to work on one, and then I thought, well, maybe I'll do the other and then put work on that. And so just shockingly, time just kind of went by. It really was surprising.
I guess my next question is, we're not young people, me and you. So shouldn't our output be a little quicker?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You're right. I think I just took for granted, when I was in my 30s and 40s that I was always just going to just have another film right around the corner. But so that's what I'm doing now, oddly enough, that I'm in my 50s. I'm, like, for instance, my wife and I are just now in post-production on our short film, and we're getting ready to do another short and another low budget feature. So I think now I'm making up for lost time, and I do have my eye on the idea that how many good years do I have left to really, have a lot of energy to work on films. So I think that's what's really motivating me to work on tons of films now.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, you made this film in the 80s, I think, or early 90s.
Yeah, I started shooting in 1995, and it came out, I first screened it in 98, but mainly from 99 to 2000 was where I got a lot of the North American screenings.
I think this would be really interesting. How did you fundraise for this film? Because we didn't have the platforms we do now.
No, you're right. It was all my own money. At the time, my wife wasn't producing with me because I hadn't even met her yet. And I actually shot it on film because back in 1995, you had to shoot everything on film. So Brewster McGee, I actually shot on 16mm black and white negative. So it was all self-funded. And you want to know one of the reasons I think I waited so long between films? Because I would shoot some of the film, then I'd have to take a bit of a break, and then I'd have to just pay off what I did spend on that portion of the film and then clear my credit cards and my line of credits, and then do the whole thing over again to finish it. So, I got into this vicious cycle of using my own money and credit cards, which is sort of like, I guess it's the cliche first feature film story that you hear about people using their own money.
You definitely have a sense of feel in this film, and my brain is just blanks, and I'm really mad at myself. I know Texas Villages is a sequel. A Peter Bogdanovich feel, I guess, is what I'm looking for. Were you going for that?
That's a director who I love, and I think because I was in black and white and shooting in black and white, I was thinking about a lot of the 70s directors that I really admired, and one of them is Peter Bogdanovich. I think about The Last Picture Show.
That's exactly what I was going for.
Yeah, and so that for me was definitely an influence in wanting to shoot black and white, for sure.
Well, according to Orson Welles, everybody looks better in black and white.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think because it was a low-budget film, we were worried that, if it was shot in color too, that maybe with the lighting, we didn't have a lot of lighting equipment and things like that. So I think black and white was a way to kind of like really almost take what was a disadvantage and turn it into an advantage and just give everything a really nice luster of the grayscale with black and white.
Now, I guess I'm going to have to ask, since you said you shot in blocks, mm-hmm. were actors okay with that? Were they well prepared it was going to be a block shot?
I think what happened was I thought we were going to shoot the whole film in about 2 weeks. And what happened is on about the third day of shooting, I realized we were never going to do that. So what I did was the two main actors that are in the car all the time, the characters of Brewster and Malcolm, they came in. I shot that in Vancouver, so they came in from Winnipeg. Everybody else was local actors. So then I realized, okay, I've got to really, like, compartmentalize and prioritize their footage and get their stuff in the can because it's going to be very expensive and time-consuming to try to get them back here later. So then I just realized my only priority at that point was shooting their scenes. And I knew a lot of the remaining scenes that involving local actors, I would have to save those for the next block.
So let's back this up. So you did get all their shooting done, or did they have to come back?
Those two actors, we shot for like almost like 12 straight days with maybe a day off in between, and I was able to get all of their stuff in, believe it or not. Like we wrapped and one morning at the drive-thru as the sun came up, and we basically those guys were on a plane like a day later.
Wow.
Back today.
I'm going to have to ask, again, this is the 90s. Where did you find them? I mean, we didn't even really have internet then.
No, you know what? I was like, I grew up with Brent, who plays Brewster, so we went to high school together. So that was a film, the character that I actually wrote for him, and also Reed, who plays Malcolm, his friend in the car. He's someone that I did a short film called Ronaldo in Winnipeg, and he was in it. And I always told him I was going to write him a part, and so I wrote this part for Brent and Reed. And, of course, I moved to Vancouver, but then I said, don't worry, I'll get you guys here. And I actually flew them out here to do this. So it was something that I had planned for a while to work with those two. The whole movie was really planned and written for those two friends of mine.
Okay, you seem to have a slight obsession with old cars. In the two films you sent me, you have a car involved, and it's a main part of the story.
Yes. You're right. Yeah, you know what? It's like, I think what happens with, like, for instance, in Brewster McGee, the whole movie, for people that might not know, it's just these two oddball characters that are friends that are just basically sit in a car in a parking lot of a fast food restaurant, and they just spin their obsessive web on this unsuspecting employee of this fast food chicken restaurant. So that was important because their world is basically inside this car. So I think, you know, it was very important for me to pick the kind of car that would really reinforce the kind of people they were. And if you see the movie, they're the kind of people that, you know, they don't maybe strike you as being the kind of people that would have a Mercedes-Benz or something. Like, I did see them as very sort of underground type people who are on the fringes of society. So I thought they would have a car that would have that kind of like, that would reinforce that characteristic of them.
How was shooting this at that time? Did people give you weird looks and stuff? Because, I mean, it's an indie film in Vancouver, and I don't see a lot of film production in Vancouver at this time.
Yeah, well, we actually shot that there was a fast food chicken franchise that was just mainly popular here in Vancouver. And believe it or not, they actually let us shoot in their parking lot. So we actually shot a lot of stuff in their parking lot. And then we went to a different franchise, like the same franchise but a different location, when we needed to shoot interiors of the restaurant and also the drive-thru. Because the original location where we shot in the parking lot didn't have a drive-thru, and we knew that we needed a drive-thru in the movie, so they actually let us shoot in a different location with the drive-thru and the interiors of the restaurant. So, but it was strange. Yeah, we shot every day. As you see, it takes place during the day, and it was just boiling hot every day. It was in the summertime, and that was the hardest part, just shooting in this parking lot 12 hours a day with the sun beating down us. And, yeah, we would have people come walking by and take a look and just move on.
Now, is the actual place called Chicken Hut?
That's a made-up thing. I just made up the Chicken Hut. I mean, I didn't check, you know, again, there was no online thing back in 1995 when we first started principal photography. So I just assumed there was no restaurant called the Chicken Hut. For all I knew, there could have been some kind of franchise somewhere in North America called the Chicken Hut. But I just obviously just tried to create some generic sounding like a franchise for a chicken restaurant.
So what was it called originally? What's this place that you're shooting at?
Oh, the actual, and there's still locations here. It's called Church's Chicken. That's a very popular Vancouver.
I do know it.
Yes. So, and the actual location, I drive by it, the one we shot at mainly, I drive by it, and basically it turned into a rental car place, and now it's being torn down for condos. So, like, I was thinking of even going by and just shooting the remnants of that place for future reference to our, when we bring Brewster McGee back for its 20th year restoration anniversary.
So hold on. Why don't you tell people, if they're in Vancouver, where the original restaurant is?
Yeah, well, like I said, it's in you know, the main area of Vancouver. It's on a street called Fraser Street. And because, like I said, you turned into an enterprise rent-a-car, and then that went out, and now it's just like a nondescript-looking building. It looks like it's about to be torn down. So I kind of wanted to get – I actually wanted just to – I drove by the other day. I thought I should just go back and just film. What I thought would be really fun was getting a couple of the actors, like Branton Reed and maybe the actor that plays Oliver, Don Ackerman. I thought it'd be kind of good for special features for our next Blu-ray DVD to maybe go there on location and just sit around and sit in a car, eat chicken, and reminisce about the times we shot that film while being on location 20 years later in where, you know, where was the original Chicken Hut restaurant.
Okay. You have a character called Mr. Harrison. He has to be based on somebody you've met in your life.
You're talking about the manager?
I'm talking about the manager.
Well, I think, you know, I think everybody, I think everybody has, like, you know, when they're younger probably has worked in some kind of McJob or at a restaurant or whatever in some capacity, whether in high school or just in university or something like that. And I think they've always had, you know, it's always been the thing when you're sort of on the lower rung of the totem pole or whatever, of the ladder in a fast food restaurant, and you have these managers or assistant managers that, you know, have no problems with ordering you around, or in some cases, you know, for what little money they're paying you, they expect some kind of real, you know, loyalty to the company, or they come across in the way that they really care for you as a person and stuff, but sometimes that doesn't seem to jive with how you're actually being treated and what limited potential you have to grow in the company when you're on that lower rung.
I don't know. I just thought the whole part of talking into his recorder all the time, like that, I thought that would be based on somebody.
No, I think I just wanted to, again, you know, I thought it was interesting that somebody that people typically consider this low level kind of McJob franchise restaurant, fast food, the idea that somebody would be walking around, you know, recording their daily thoughts or their thoughts that could improve the restaurant or could improve things like that. I thought that sort of self-importance, that it would show that this person is walking around with a sense of self-importance that would probably outstrip their actual place in society.
Fair enough. Roscoe Cohen's fake too then?
Oh, yeah, that was an homage to somebody. Me. Yes, that's right, Roscoe's Cohen. That's always been my nickname, Roscoe.
Oh, okay.
Ross. I have all my friends, but it's funny because no one, when I grew up in Winnipeg, you know, of course, when I go back to Winnipeg, you know, all these years later, all the people I went to high school with, when I see them, they all call me Roscoe. And even my wife says, I've never heard anybody call you that. And so, yeah, since I moved away and I'm out here in my life here in Vancouver, nobody calls me that. But when I go back to Winnipeg, everything just slips back into that high school cadence.
Okay. When you start off your film, you go with a drum roll and music, and that's really the rest of the music of the film doesn't really show up again.
Yeah, there's not a lot of, you're right. I wanted to start it off with the sort of drum roll and almost like a military kind of music to open the credits to sort of present this idea that you're dealing with this person, the main person, Brewster McGee, the main character, who's very outspoken and belligerent, and he's very derogatory towards a lot of people, and I like the idea that he's almost at war with everybody and at war with life. So I wanted to create this very militaristic music soundtrack at the beginning that kind of reinforced this idea that this guy just sits in a car, like almost like in his military bunker, and he's at verbal war with everything he sees and with everything that he thinks about. And so that's kind of why I use that style of music. But throughout the movie, like you say, there wasn't a lot of music throughout the actual movie itself. I just used that to really load up the expectation of the audience in terms of like I wanted to kind of prepare them that you're about to meet this person who is constantly going to be at war with society.
So do you feel you have a woman in the thing that's, I call her a lost soul woman. She's got all the napkins and she's just sitting there. We don't really know much about her. Was that just like, okay, I'm going to put this character in, I'm going to put that character in? Because I see you do that a lot throughout the film, just drop people in.
Yeah, I wanted to because I did have a you know, I had several jobs like that just in high school and just out of high school where I worked in, you know, and that one is really, that character was actually directly related. I worked at this sort of diner place where they had these regulars that just came in all the time. And that's really where Brewster McGee, the idea came from, was the idea, like I used to just see these sort of what people might think of as being these oddball characters, but they're like always there. Like it's almost like I used to wonder when I worked there, like what, do these guys have no lives? Like they would be there in the morning having breakfast, then they leave, then they come back an hour later, they'd be there for 3 hours for lunch, and they come, and they were just always there. And there were several of them. And I kept thinking like this, you know, diner or restaurant, it's like their life. And that's where I got the idea for Brewster. What about these, if these characters were just hanging around this restaurant all day long and this was their whole world? And so like this character, there was somebody there that used to go to a woman that used to go to this restaurant that I worked at. And she used to sit there, and I don't know if she was homeless or maybe she might've had, you know, some mental illness issues. I'm not sure. Cause she used to sit there. She used to put on a lot of lipstick and she would order maybe bacon and eggs or something, but then she would just sit there with her coffee cup and just, she would constantly put, you know, kiss the coffee cup and kiss all these napkins and just leave her red lipstick imprint on all these things. And I would, when she would leave, I'd have to come by and sort of clean her table, and it'd be like 100 of these napkins all with her, with the images of her lipstick, and I'd have her coffee cup just covered in lipstick kisses. And so that actually, I did that character, and she was kind of lonely. She just sat there by herself all day long. She never said nothing. So that character was really like a direct, like, copy of that real life situation that I put right into the movie. Just to kind of add, I just wanted to kind of, you know, kind of like match that feeling that I had when I grew up working in that kind of place, and just to kind of give the movie itself the flavor of these sort of like this cavalcade of these oddball, fringe kind of characters that just populated this movie, really.
You also, characters discuss an obsession with fries.
French fries?
I had French fries throughout the film. Brewster makes comments, and so is Malcolm, but wow, we got a lot of fries.
Yeah, I know. I think, yeah, exactly. I think, you know, obviously when you're working in that fast food thing, element, and the character just seemed to live at a fast food restaurant, I just thought it'd be interesting that, you know, like the main character, Brewster, as you know by seeing the movie, or anyone who has seen the movie, he just talks and talks forever. He's a talker, and he loves the sound of his own voice. He thinks he's very self-important about everything he says. And so even when he talks about something as banal as French fries or chicken dinners, or he likes to pontificate about those things like he has some kind of like grandiose inner knowledge that most people don't have. You know, even when he's talking about something as ridiculous as French fries, he's never lacking in any grandiose theories and opinions about the most, like, mundane matters even.
Let's go on about a few other things. I mean, he does have us go on about the sex going on in the car next to him. Mm-hmm, he's very obsessive about that.
Yeah, I think it was more like, I think that I wanted to show, because I wanted to really reinforce the fact that that was their world that they lived in. So, you know, Brewster has a pair of binoculars and he just sits in his car and he's looking at the world and he likes to see everything, which is eventually how the assistant manager of the restaurant, he ends up in sort of ensnaring that character by constantly watching him amongst other things and just noticing that this looks like a particularly vulnerable person over time. You can sense that. And with Brewster being very cynical and very controlling, he doesn't waste any time in sort of pondering the idea like, well, maybe this is someone that, you know, he can try to reach out to and be friends to, because it's, you know, there's nothing Brewster likes more than having vulnerable human beings under his control, in under the guise of friendship, of course.
Of course. You do. I got to say, I really liked you wrapping up your plot line on the toilet paper. You bring it in early, you bring it around a second time, and you finish it off in the third act.
Yeah, you know, you're right about that. Yeah, I guess there's just some things that are just like, you know, like as a screenwriter, sometimes you have a lot of fun with the idea of introducing something and seeing if it's possible, you know, even if it's not a main plot point, but just sort of almost like a fun kind of thing that you know, you can really keep it, I was going to say keep it rolling like toilet paper, but some kind of a little fun plot device that you can keep the undercurrent of that plot device so that it actually has some kind of a, in this case, hopefully a comedic payoff at the end. And you're right. When I show that movie, we did screen that movie theatrically all over North America. And I was, you know, I have to say that, you know, there's some things I thought are funny in the movie that sometimes people laugh at in audiences and sometimes they don't. But that is the one thing that you just pointed out, I would say, has been very consistent in terms of audiences kind of appreciating and laughing, is the toilet paper gag that eventually reaches a conclusion near the end of the film. You're right.
I think my favorite part of the scene is when we discuss Brewster's catchphrase in the car.
Oh, yeah, he has a catchphrase, you know, because I felt like, you know, again, it all speaks to his self-importance that he thinks he's, you know, he's created all these things, because that actually is based on, I think, almost around the time that we were filming Brewster McGee, there were things in the news where people were like, there were people who were just copywriting all kinds of phrases and things with the idea that, you know, especially with the advent of the internet coming up and websites and stuff, there were people that were just like, you know, coming up with all kinds of things where they just would want to copyright everything with the idea that, you know, they thought they could make money. Like, for instance, if they would be the first to copyright something by a car company or something. And then when the car company wanted to create a website or something, they'd have to go to them to get the domain name or whatever. So that was kind of inspired from what I was seeing in the news, where people were trying to like copyright even just things like it could just be everyday things. Like I know, like there was a NBA basketball coach, you know, who came up with the idea of winning three championships in a row, calling it three-peat, and he copyrighted that. So now, like, he's the owner of the, and yet it's a common thing that people say, like, if you win three championships, hey, hope you can three-peat. And yet this person thought, like, I'm going to copyright that. So, like, people can't use that unless, like, they pay me and stuff. So a lot of Brewster's, his catchphrase and his self-importance that he attached to it was based on that inspiration.
Well, there you go. See, you're way ahead of yourself. See, we're ready for the internet.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. Yeah, like when I think, and you know, it's funny, even some of the things, you know, just talking about a movie now 20 years later, Brewster McGee, it's like there's a lot of things you realize how a lot of it is just pure fortune, because things that you see in a movie, or like you may bring out through your questions and observations, you bring out thoughts in me that I don't even know that I even consciously sometimes put things in like that, but you kind of give me pause to think like, no, you know, maybe, and you always think about stuff like, I'll always think you might trigger something talking about your observations of the film that make me realize, oh yeah, that happened to me in high school. Like just when I gave you the reference of when I worked at that restaurant, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. And I think that I don't even know how much that was consciously put in the script and how much of that was sort of subliminal on my part.
So I think this applies to both your movies. It's the words of wisdom Brewster gives me. Rule number one, don't believe what a woman tells you. Rule number two, don't believe what a woman tells you. Now, did you take that to both films? Because I would say it applies in both situations.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think, you know, like with, I mean, it's amazing how times have changed. You know, we shot that movie from 95 to 97, 1997, and one of the things I wanted to make clear, like with Brewster, because he's like an equal opportunity hater. I mean, he'll put down, you name it, he'll put it down. He'll put down, like, everything. But he does seem to go on a lot about putting a lot of blame on women for things. And I thought, like, for me, I thought that was important that he be like that, because I needed to show that, you know, for a person like Brewster, he probably never, ever wants to accept responsibility for his position in life, which is really he's a middle-aged guy sitting in a car in a parking lot of a chicken restaurant all day long, day after day. So there's not a lot to feel proud about, probably. But it's very important for his own ego to constantly be lashing out and blaming people. So one of the things he does is a lot in the film is he really lashes out at women. But I had a lot of women working on the film, and I get really strong, like, positive responses from female audience members, because I think they really do see that a lot of that braggadocio or the things that he lashes out verbally against women, it's very obvious to people that it really is a sign of a very weak, scared person who feels the need to bring himself up in the world. He has to rip people down. And I think that is something that, because I think it's really important to show him like that, because I'm not giving the ending away, but it's very important that there's an arc in the film where, you know, eventually he gets his comeuppance, you know, and he has to answer for all of his lies and all of his hate-filled rhetoric and everything. And he has to look in the mirror really and kind of answer to something. And I think he gets outed for the coward in a way that he, you know, that those type of people, when they put down a lot of other people and insult them, really they're being very cowardly in terms of not being able to deal with their own issues, in my opinion.
You also do go have a sex show that shows up on the radio. So I'd say it's sort of the dawn of Dr. Ruth, I would say, is around this time.
You're absolutely right. That was totally based on. There was a lot of, like, either nationally syndicated shows like Dr. Ruth, or there are these ones in Canada or in Vancouver or Toronto, like, you know, Sunday Night Sex with Sue, and there's all these shows where people would phone in. And I mean, now that must seem really weird because I don't even know, you know, we don't even have that kind of radio anymore. Everything's like satellite radio and everything's like, you know, like, so now, like, there really were those things, you know, where people would phone in to a radio personality and to generally get their advice, especially if it was more something that they didn't feel comfortable talking about with people they knew. And so there is an element where they're listening to like a phone-in like sex show on the radio. And that was really important to why I wanted a really old car and everything too, because I wanted to show in some ways the character of Brewster sitting in this car. In a lot of ways, he hadn't grown up either. So he's listening to old, you know, radio. Like you see the car, he's got an old radio dial, beat-up radio, and it sounds all staticky and the car is all beat up. And I just wanted to keep reinforcing that this was a person who was not growing in life and growing in time. He was like stuck in this world of these old cars and old radios and old everything about him was like refusing to move forward in life. And so that these are all things that I kind of and to fast forward to the most recent feature, Legacy of Whining, getting back to your original observation about old cars, that was very important too with the character of Mitch in Legacy of Whining, for someone who's always living in the past, just like Brewster, to have like a really old car and to talk constantly about what it was like to be in high school and to almost wish that life was like it was back in high school. So, and there's also a fixation with him listening to an old cassette deck in his car and it doesn't work properly. So there just now I can see that there's all these, things that tether both of those movies, together in a way.
You do have quotes all throughout the film at the beginning of the chapters. Where did they come from? I mean, obviously you tell me who says them, but why did you use them?
Well, I think, yeah, I did use quotes. And I think maybe because it was also like a short film, like it's a feature. It's just sort of like over 60 minutes. And I think, you know, I thought I'm just going to break up into chapters and maybe that will give it a sense of like people will think it's maybe feels a little longer. Like it feels a little bit more like a feature length kind of a film. So that's why I kind of I just thought, and I don't know, I might have seen some movies at the time, and I think I've always been a big fan of movies where, you know, and maybe that's a European thing, I don't know, with European movies, but I've always been a big fan of, like, movies that have chapters, and I think even in Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters, he has chapters, and I think I've always kind of liked that idea, because I'm also a big reader, and I love novels, and I love to celebrate novels, and I think that's more of a novelistic approach, obviously, breaking things down in chapters. But I like the idea when filmmakers have done that. So I think that was also part of it, which is that influence that I've had with all these films that I've liked that use chapters.
I have a couple last minor things. There are no cars in the drive-thru when he says there's a backup.
You're absolutely
not one car. Because I looked for them. I'm like, there's no cars here. I'm going to call you out on that one.
No, no. But are you talking about where, like, when the guy says you got to keep moving along?
Yes.
No, but that was, believe it or not, this sounds like an excuse. But that was the joke we were trying to do. It's like, because this assistant manager was so, at that point, he had really broken off with Brewster and wanted nothing to do with them. The fact that he was willing to say to Brewster when it was so obvious that it wasn't true, you know, hey, I'd love to talk to you guys, but can you move it along? Because we're really backed up. And I think that was, and then I think we did, that was on purpose because we wanted to reinforce the idea that he was willing to totally lie to Brewster or insult Brewster because Brewster probably looked in his mirror and saw that there was no cars behind him. And I think that was his way, really, of saying to Brewster, like, I don't want to talk to you anymore. I think you know and I know there's no cars behind you, but I'm going to tell you to move your ass because really what I'm saying to you is, adios, I'm done with you, right? Like, but you're right, and we laughed about that because it was funny that there was no cars coming, but it's both done on purpose. I kid you not.
Okay, that's fine. My last thing, you do show a shot of a book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
Yes.
Why is that in the shot?
Well, because again, so we talked about the idea that, you know, I mean, we have this sort of idea in our head that these fast food restaurants or these Mick job kind of things, they're very basic and they don't really require a lot of skill. And you don't typically think of them as having this kind of like philosophical or intellectual oversight with anything to do with running of them. And the idea of the seven pillars of wisdom that they refer to like this manual, this how-to manual to run the Chicken Hut. It's based on the title of T.E. Lawrence's autobiography that they made, Lawrence of Arabia, which is called The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. So that was a bit of an inside joke that, you know, you'd have to have a little bit of a memory or sort of like what the name of the, you know, because when you think of T.E. Lawrence, you think of this great statesman and, ended up being this person who was this influential post, you know, early 20th century political figure that obviously they made Lawrence of Arabia out of, and he was a very controversial figure. And I thought it'd be interesting to somehow, you know, that the Chicken Hut would somehow attach that same level of importance to their manual on how to run their restaurant, and would give it the same kind of lofty title that T. E. Lawrence would have for his autobiography.
Do you still own the Chicken Hut book?
I have a box in storage where I've got all the outtakes footage. I've got all the sound footage. I've got, believe me, like if I ever had the money or time, I mean, I could put together all kinds of like outtakes and whatever. And I've got all the props, even some of the hats, the Chicken Hut hats. I've got, yeah, like that manual, that's the actual Chicken Hut manual that we're referring to, the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. I'm sure I've got that. It's all in a box. It's all stuck away. And again, we are planning for the 20th anniversary, which is probably this year, but I think we're going to say it's next year. We're going to put together a fully up-to-date 4K restoration, which it'll look really nice because the movie was shot on film, on 16mm film. We'll probably go through LA. There's a company that will do that, and it's going to look amazing. We'll clean up the sound, and we'll put a great, and we'll do some theatrical stuff. Like we did show it all across Canada, theatrical. I traveled across Canada. I traveled across the United States and just individually booked theaters. I got places to program it, and I think it'd be really cool to do the 20th anniversary and have some actual audience screenings with a really beautiful new digital black and white gorgeous DCP print.
Okay, that's it for me in the film. I could ask you more about actors, but I think we did pretty good.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
I think we did good, but you ready for your usual fun questions?
Sure, absolutely.
Because I know you've prepped for the last 4 months since your last ones for these ones.
Oh, yeah, I just need a drink of water, though. Give me 1 second.
You're more than welcome to have one. Oh, I know my last question before I get there. Do you still talk to all the actors?
Oh, yeah. Well, mainly Brent, who plays Brewster, because he was my friend, like, throughout most of my life. He still lives in Winnipeg. So I was actually, my wife, Marie, and I were actually in Winnipeg last year working on a film, like, doing some research for a film we're doing. And, of course, we spent time with him. So Oh yeah, and even the one who plays Malcolm, we've been to see him a few times as well. I don't get to talk to him as much, whereas like because he's not on social media and stuff like that. Whereas Brent is, and Brent is an actor, so he's still involved. And so yeah, we talk all the time.
Okay. Your favorite book?
Catch 22.
Fair enough. Your favorite restaurant, and what do you order?
Favorite restaurant. I mean just local restaurants or like a sort of a name restaurant. I like the Keg, which is like a franchise place for steak and all that.
Let's have something more exciting than the Keg. I'm not going to Vancouver for the Keg.
Yeah, no, I mean in Vancouver there's what I love is there's restaurants now that make the wood oven pizza, which I'm crazy about. And that's a new trend here. I don't know if it's like that where you are, but here in Vancouver, there's like 20 of those now that just opened up.
Oh, wow.
Where it's like a real old Tuscany Neapolitan oven that's at 600 degrees. They just shove it in for like a minute or something.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
So that's I'm all over that now. There's tons of them.
Since you've told me you've traveled all across Canada, what's your favorite province and why?
Well, excluding where I'm living now, Toronto, like, Ontario is very close to my heart because I did go to film school for 3 years at Humber College in Toronto. So, and of course, I'm a big fan of the Toronto Film Festival. So, and I actually, when I got out of high school, I played in a band, and I remember we did tour in Ontario a little bit. We even went to Thunder Bay, thankfully in the summertime. So I do have I really like Ontario a lot, obviously, and of course Manitoba, where I'm from. But I've never actually been east provincially. I've never been east of Ontario.
Oh, wow. You missed Quebec. Quebec's wonderful.
Yeah. I've never been east, and I know the Maritimes are supposed to be beautiful. So basically I've spent a lot of time in, you know, obviously everything from Ontario west, I've spent a lot of time in various provinces.
Okay. Before I let you go, I didn't know you had a website, and then I just stumbled upon it today.
So, it's my blog. It's www.holycinema.com. Like holy cinema, meaning like holy is in WHOLLY cinema.
So what do you do on your website? What's it for?
Well, I mean, I like to interview and promote, artists mainly in film, obviously, but also, and artists from all over the world. I've talked like what you're doing. I've done via Skype, different filmmakers. Talk to independent filmmakers in Canada, in the United States, all over the place, actors. And here in Vancouver, people are very receptive and sometimes we just might have, for instance, there could be a comedian coming to play here and I'll hear a good buzz about that person and excuse me. And so I'll contact them by social media and say, here's my Holy Cinema blog post. And they're very enthusiastic. I usually like to meet them if I can. That way I can get some photographs to put. A lot of times I just do email questions, or a lot of times, but mainly I do it on the phone. So I like to kind of, sometimes I do reviews or my thoughts on trends in film and things like that, or music. But so I'm pretty open just in general to writing about and promoting artists in all regimens of the artistic field, but I do, as the title Holy Cinema suggests, I do mainly kind of focus on film.
So where can people get this great movie?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Brewster McGee, we did put it out on DVD and we did distribute it for a while, but now it's, you know, the original run of the copies sold out, and really since we've gone on making other films, and I mean, if anybody wants, trust me, I do have a couple of boxes full of DVDs. But the problem now is, you know, we really need to, you know, the levels of technology has become so upgraded in the last 10 years that, you know, we've gone really, really laid low with the film, because in the last couple of years, we really have become very high on the idea that we're going to move forward this upcoming year with really, like, you know, readdressing Brewster McGee and giving it the technological video upgrading that it deserves to take its place in the modern world, so people can like download it and would be able to download it and things like that, like in really a really beautiful, you know, up to par picture quality.
Well, yeah, I mean, also promote your other film. So they can't find that one. Where can they find Legacy of Winning?
Well, Legacy of Whining is...
Sorry.
You know what? I like that, because you know what? I feel like I'm winning when I think about a Legacy of Whining. But what we're doing... Well, that's available on all... Like, that's available on all... On, like, digital downloads. It's available... Legacy of Whining is available on iTunes, Amazon Prime, Google... you can download it on all those online digital platforms. It's also available on Amazon on Blu-ray and DVD, a special edition Blu-ray. We've got some good special features on there. And and that's available on Blu-ray as well, like all over the world. But Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, you can get Legacy of Whining.
Well, thank you for your time as always, and I look forward to your next thing.
Oh, I really appreciate it, and thanks for your support. And anytime, I'm always very happy and very appreciative to take part in talking with you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page. Thank you.